Welcome to the New Urban Architect Podcast, a collection of interviews with design professionals about the role of architecture within new urbanism.
It's great to have as our guest today urban designer Jeff Speck. Formerly Director of Design at National Endowment for the Arts, Jeff leads his own city planning practice in Washington, D.C. He is co-author of Suburban Nation, as well as the recently published Smart Growth Manual. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brad. I appreciate being included.
Absolutely. You recently wrote an interesting article titled, Why They Hate Us, and in it you address some of the most common objections that are brought against the ideas of new urbanism. For the benefit of those who haven't yet read the article, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of it?
I would enjoy that for a number of reasons. One reason is that it was, by necessity, a 750-word article, which if you've ever tried to write that, is an extremely short stretch. And so I wasn't able to communicate everything that I wanted. Another reason is that some of the, I think, intended lightness or irony of the article perhaps did not fully translate. So if you read the comments, and there was a lively back and forth between some hardcore new urbanists, some hardcore traditionalists, classicists, and others, and the more, shall we say, avant-garde community in the comments after that article, if you read that, which I did with great enjoyment, and I must say a certain amount of I had to kind of step back and approach it with the desire to have enjoyment, because otherwise it would have been very easy to get wrapped up in it. But there was such a lively debate that followed it, and some of the debate, I thought, had understood the tone of the article as it was written. Some of it were people who didn't fully comprehend the irony. So it's nice to have an opportunity to discuss it in more detail. By necessity, given both the need to rebut, in a sense, an earlier critique in one of the only critical reviews the Smart Growth Manual has gotten, but also in an attempt to provide, you know, entertaining grist for a magazine that likes to be entertaining, I intentionally oversimplified the discussion in a way that I think in some ways was unfair to some of the more thoughtful critics of the movement, and I'd like to talk about that. Mm-hmm. But in that context, let me now say that for the sake of brevity and humor, we divided the principal objectors to new urbanism into three categories, which I characterize as the libs, the mods, and the saints. Should we go through each one of those?
Yeah, let's do it. Go ahead.
So the libs stood not for liberals, of which I count myself among that group, but for libertarians. And it's interesting that it got some objection from friends of mine in the new urbanism who are libertarian or who characterize themselves as libertarian. But while not all libertarians are against the new urbanism by any means, the strongest and most vocal, and I should say the most funded group that you find saying things against the new urbanism tend to come from the libertarian think tanks, or I should say tend to be funded by petrodollars. And that's a bold statement I didn't make in my article because I didn't want to be called to task for it. But the most prominent anti-new urbanist speakers, and I've had to go head-to-head with them at conferences, are people who are working for or funded by institutes like Cato and American Enterprise and others who receive their principal funding from, or I should say a large amount of their funding, from the gasoline companies, from the roadway builders, from the auto manufacturers, etc. Mm-hmm. So they've been the best funded group because they have a lot to lose from the new urbanism's walkable, accessible communities as an alternative to everyone driving everywhere all the time to get everything. So I didn't get so political in the discussion, but I talked about how this is the group. And by the way, it was the easy group to start with because the author of the critique that appeared in Architect Magazine, Bob Brugman, is he came from that direction. Now, I have to say that Bob Brugman, to the best of my knowledge, is not one of these think tankers who's funded by the powers that be. He is merely a contrarian, and he's a very good one. He's a very thoughtful one, a very skillful one. I've also gone head-to-head with him at events where we've given back-to-back lectures that were completely contradictory, essentially him calling me, in not using this term, him calling me a liar and all the things that I was presenting. And if you read his book Sprawl, which is a very interesting book, well-titled Sprawl, A Compact History, he is able to, through I would say, very creative use of statistics, to rebut many of the New Urbanist articles in ways that may make sense statistically, but always seem to miss one part of the argument that would explain it more fully and cast doubt on his doubting. He is a very effective doubter, and he is not, as far as I know, a hardcore libertarian, nor he may not even consider himself a libertarian, but the critique that he poses towards smart growth is pretty similar to the critique that you have coming from the libertarian think tanks, that building highways didn't really cause sprawl, that the FHA and VA home loan programs didn't really cause sprawl, that white flight didn't really cause sprawl. And, you know, he's even a bit skeptical about global warming in his book, which allowed me to make him look worse, perhaps, than he should look, because he is a thoughtful academic. That said, he and his arguments represent the other folks' views who we most often have to deal with at conferences. And when, in rare occasion, when a conference is sponsored, when a planning conference is sponsored by organizations that include extremely hard right supporters, you find that one of these experts is speaking on the panel, and it's really discombobulating because you get up on stage. This happened to me once in Louisville, and I actually very much, it's the only time I've ever lectured and truly upset my host. I got up on stage in Louisville after one of these fellows. And I can't remember if it was Randall O'Toole. I think it was Randall O'Toole, who's well known in New Urbanist circles as a leading skeptic. Mm-hmm. And instead of giving the lecture that I was asked to give, I rebutted everything that he had said because it was so false about the roles of highways and loan programs and other things in creating sprawl. So anyway. That's the first group, and it's the group that I think evokes the most ire and you know, spitting anger in the New Urbanists, because we feel that unlike the other two groups which I'm going to name, many of them are motivated less by intellectual rigor or by a true desire to improve the world, as they are by the desire to maintain the status quo that benefits them and their supporters.
So would it be fair to say that you would say the Libs' main objection to New Urbanism is that it would reduce our dependency on the automobile industry?
Well, that's not what they're going to say. Mm-hmm. But the discussion, and in fact, thank you for putting me back on track. Libertarians' principal argument, or people who call themselves libertarians, principal argument against smart growth is that it's going to result in more rules, more red tape, more government, and less freedom of choice. And of course, the answer to that is that almost, and people who people like Vince Graham, who are, you know, more open to libertarian thought, argue very effectively, as we try, and certainly most developers make this clear, that the reason they turn to the New Urbanism is because the existing rules, processes, and red tape kept them from building great communities. And so the standard, and by now I think well echoed, New Urbanist rebuttal to the libertarian critique is that almost every project we've ever worked on has been about reducing red tape and reducing impediments to building the way that people want to build, and making better communities possible, not creating more laws and rules, et cetera, to make any sort of development more difficult. Now, it's a more nuanced discussion than that, however. You would never find in a 750-word article, because if you read our Smart Growth Manual, for example, that's the most recent, my most recent collaboration with Andres, there are a lot of calls for government to play a role, and in some cases a larger role. But I think that it's a balanced discussion, and I think on the whole, any objective libertarian critic who truly were to learn about what smart growth meant would find that net-net, it would result in much more freedom for development than it would constrictions.
You mentioned that you're a lib as in a liberal. Well, I myself, I'm a lib as in a libertarian. However, I happen to love new urbanism. While for many people that would seem to be a contradiction because, like you say, so many libertarians have a problem with new urbanism, I would say that they have two main problems in their argument. Even in a libertarian utopia, if a libertarian takes the position that you just can't have new urbanism, they're taking the position that a private developer can't go buy his own land and build it how he wants.
Yep, yep.
They're taking the
because
position...
all the existing regimes that exist that currently stop that from happening.
Exactly. They're taking the position that people cannot volunteer themselves into the kind of community they'd like to live in. You know, taken to its logical conclusion, those libertarians should actually really hate developments like Amish communities and things like that,
right?
Because there's all kinds of rules that they wouldn't want to live
right.
in. So
those rules.
Yeah, those libertarians should actually want to make those Amish communities illegal, which I find kind of ironic.
In response to your general, you know, to your libertarian flag waving, and I'm glad you've identified, you know, I'll try not to offend you anymore. There was a very interesting email discussion between Jeff Graham, Vince Graham, and myself following this article about what it really meant to be a libertarian. And what Jeff and Vince were arguing was that the, I shouldn't be picking on the libertarians because here, you know, and mentioning certain positive things about libertarian discussion. But we came to the mutual conclusion that the reason that we were uncomfortable with these critics of the new urbanism, from the think tanks, for example, is because they weren't arguing a libertarian. Even though they were working for a libertarian think tank, they were not pushing a libertarian angle.
Exactly.
They were actually pushing an angle that supported the existing regimes and the existing, you know, winners and the existing status quo, and that we're actually stopping the free market from working efficiently. This idea that somehow, when you look at the amount of money that goes, even in the latest, most progressive ICE-T legislation, you look at the amount of money that goes to highway funding versus transit funding, and they're going to argue that there isn't an extremely powerful subsidy currently in place supporting auto motion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these quote-unquote libertarians aren't truly libertarian. They're just part of the system, if I could say that. And again, I would exempt Bob Brueggemann from this classification. I think that he's just a contrarian, which is a whole different class of folks. The mods, the second category, shall we talk about them?
Yeah, let's do it.
I had a little more misgivings about, because a lot of my friends are the mods. It's some weird fluke of disposition with me that I didn't turn out as one because, you know, I grew up in a architect's collaborative house that was done by an apprentice to Gropius, and I went to the Graduate School of Design at Harvard, and I've always absolutely loved modern architecture. But somehow I noticed when I got to school and at the GSD that there were certain people who were, if I could say this, were kind of blind to the benefits of new urbanism. We agreed on everything else, but they just couldn't stomach it. And there were a number of other people who appreciated it, But like all of us, we're critical or self-critical regarding some of its challenges. But if I can make a really bold and perhaps get me in hot water discussion, I found the people who were more open to new urbanism were the ones who had more of a liberal arts background and more of a general, perhaps they were a bit older and they had a bit more life experience. And the ones who had the most knee-jerk reaction against new urbanism were the ones who'd gone straight through architecture school from birth and had either spent less time, getting a broader education, mm-hmm. or tended to look at things more from a strictly design perspective than from a, social issues perspective.
Very interesting.
It gets more subtle than that, and hope I'm not condemning anyone, but that is a general correlation that I noticed. There are a limited number of people, and they're easy to pick on, and they're by no means the most thoughtful critics, who just can't stand traditional architecture. And it colors their view of the new urbanism dramatically. Similarly, there are a great number of people, and the New Urbanist Conference includes many of them, who can't stomach modern architecture. And I have to say, when I was at the NEA and I put together my grant-giving panels, I would always try to have one person on every panel who couldn't stand modern architecture. I always try to have one person on my panel who couldn't stand traditional architecture, because these are voices that you need to hear. But it's just interesting how, for some people, what's most insidious about it is that these preferences are often not discussed.
Mm-hmm.
So from either side, either a traditionalist or a modernist will reject proposals and concepts that are presented in the vocabulary of the style that they can't stand without discussing that they can't stand it. And certainly I saw this happen repeatedly at the GSD. You didn't dare... I mean, you would not just the professors. I mean, the students would laugh you out of the building if you used traditional architecture. And I can think about a former colleague of mine at DPZ, Juan Batista, wonderful guy, who was so proud and so committed to the more vernacular vocabulary that he used that he insisted on presenting projects at the GSD that were traditional, and it was he had a horrible, horrible experience there. I mean, he graduated, he did fine, and now I'm sure he's a productive member of society. And he's a wonderful person. So imagine, this person with this handsome guy with a great personality just getting abused because he's presenting very good designs in a vocabulary that wasn't accepted. But the larger point there is a couple things. First, that, there are these folks for whom style is everything, and they're never going to accept the new urbanism, and we shouldn't try. That's one point. But the larger point is that style doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some ways that style can matter. For example, as we say in the Smart Growth Manual, style can masquerade difference. So, first of all, you don't want poor people's housing to be in a different style than middle-class housing in a given area, because it's what Robert Campbell calls a billboard of indigence. Mm-hmm. Poor people live here. But secondarily, within projects, having a similar style, whatever style it might be, including modernist, having a similar style for the more expensive housing, the cheaper housing, the commercial, the office, the stores, allows you to mix uses better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important message of new urbanism, and you see it in many new urban projects, is that you can actually mask difference and make difference possible and make diversity possible by having a consistent architectural vocabulary. That's a point that's worth making. But the larger point is that style doesn't matter, and the line from the from our book Suburban Nation, and I'll paraphrase, I forget how it originally went, is that a true arch is no more ethical. A true cantilever is no more ethical than a false arch across 6 acres of parking. And the point is that if we don't make the right sort of environments to hold these buildings, then the quality of the buildings themselves doesn't matter. And mm-hmm. in a sea of parking, who really cares whether you've got a really well-executed deconstructivist facade or some stupid fake arches, right? That's the point we make in Suburban Nation that I made in this article very briefly, and that we continue to hammer. The style of these projects may be a means to an end, but it's just not an important part of the project, except to the degree that it helps you get the project built. And that's the final point that we keep stressing, is that it's hard enough to get mixed uses. It's hard enough to get transit. It's hard enough to get low-income housing, et cetera, into these projects, typically middle-class projects. It's hard enough to get all those things, narrower streets and regularly planted trees and all the things that we try to accomplish. It's hard enough to do that, period. When you add an architectural vocabulary which turns off the often fairly conventional review boards that have to review them, it's unnecessarily suicidal. And I have a number of friends who say, you know, Jeff, new urbanism, love it, all well and good, but why can't you do more modern stuff in these projects? And the answer is, of course, there are some in which that happens, and it's in places where there's more openness to that style. Mm-hmm. But the real answer is it just doesn't matter. get off of the style discussion. Now, God knows this is going to be a long discussion, but there's another group of people among the quote-unquote mods who have a much more sophisticated view of things and who I didn't address in the article because it would, subtlety takes time and words. And many of these are my professors and my friends at the GSD, and they are uncomfortable with the new urbanism because it presents a simple set of answers.
Mm-hmm.
New urbanism is in some ways antithetical to our best institutions of higher learning, because higher learning is all about asking questions and about broadening the discussion and about not reaching easy conclusions. And this is the discussion that's so much missed in much of the new urban critique, which is that simple dialectic thinking, right way, wrong way, is extremely useful and extremely helpful. And it's why I have a fruitful planning practice. But it's not enough for the deepest possible intellectual discourse. And so at a place like Harvard or Yale or Penn or, frankly, a lot of good non-Ivy schools, new urban thinking, because it presents a series of clearly coded rights and wrongs, shuts down the discussion. And shutting down the discussion is not acceptable. So here I think is a case of the perfect being the enemy of the good. And new urbanism is all about the good. It's all about taking all those mediocre places in America, or worse, and making them good enough. Whereas any truly innovative and mind-blowing new urban environment is going to have a more sophisticated discussion going on. Don't mean to say that new urbanists aren't participating as much as anyone in the creation of those environments, but if you look at the smart code and the other documents that new urbanist firms and new urbanists have presented, it's all about the promulgation of the good as opposed to the creation of some progressive new perfection. And in schools, that sort of system of conclusions is not acceptable within a regime of completely open-ended intellectual discourse.
Have you had a chance to check out the town of Serenby, just south of Atlanta?
Uh-huh, I've been there.
I bring it up because what's interesting about it to me is, as Andres says, Andres Dewani, it breaks all the rules, but it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
do you have any thoughts on Serenby?
Yeah, I mean, the way Serenby was planned, I think it's kind of been named New Urbanist after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Serenby does a lot of things incredibly well, and it applied a much more holistic attitude towards smart growth than was was at that time present within the New Urbanist discourse, and I think it's one of the projects that's expanded the New Urbanist discourse to include, you know, more discussion of agriculture, more discussion of water treatment and other issues that are also, you know, key aspects of us creating sustainable places.
Mm-hmm.
My objection to Serenbe as a concept is that the land plan was an alpha and an omega, you know, the Greek letters applied to the site in a way that theoretically could have been completely ignorant of topography and drainage and other issues that other people would tell you is more important than the spiritual value behind these letters,
mm-hmm.
which for the developers was profound. You go there, however, it happens to work. I'm not sure what would have happened if the site didn't work with those particular curves on it.
Mm-hmm.
But happily, it all did work out. But I have to say that approach, that one aspect of the design, seems antithetical to more practical New Urban thinking. But certainly there are ways, and indeed there's a certain compulsion to take New Urbanism to the next level by integrating its very practical mandates of how to use the site with more formal imposition of shapes and beauty, certainly due to Dhani's plans for academic cities in India,
mm-hmm.
which are based on spiritually significant shapes over there. They work beautifully, and they take the typical New Urban technique of properly sized streets and blocks and buildings and add a formal element that turn them into art.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the wrong approach. It's just an approach, you know, adding that other element to it. You know, I think most of us feel it shouldn't lead the parade. It just needs to be a part of the parade.
That's a good way to put it.
So to round out our discussion, with the most subtle aspect of all, I characterize this third group as the saints. And the saints are the group that don't want to get their hands dirty, or don't feel that we should get our hands dirty with building better-looking sprawl. And I say that with a small sense of irony. But for a lot of people, a community like Kentlands, which is just light years ahead of everything around it in terms of how it deals with the landscape, how the kids can walk to school, how you can you know, walk to soccer and walk to the store, and the incredibly improved quality of life of the people who live in Kentlands compared to the people who live in the surrounding area. For a number of people, including Alex Marshall, who wrote eloquently, but I would say incorrectly, about this for Metropolis magazine years ago, it's really just bare-looking sprawl because it's low density, because its transit connections are limited, and because it's a predominantly upper-middle-class community with a limited amount of income diversity, even though there's a wide amount of housing diversity. And basically, looking at our projects for as is absolutely reasonable, critiquing them for where they fail to accomplish the stated goals of New Urbanism. And first of all, there's a lot of projects that call themselves New Urbanists that aren't. And one of the reasons we wrote the Smart Growth Manual was to help to define that so that we don't get these posers bringing us down. When Andres first dreamed up the CNU, and like many great New Urban ideas, I think they came, you know, they were hatched directly from the skull of Andres Duany. When he came up with the idea of the CNU, he said the reason we need to do this is because the greatest risk to the movement is having the term of New Urbanism degraded and being applied to inferior work.
Right.
And that has certainly happened, and therefore an easy answer, but an incomplete answer to the critique is to say, "Oh, if you don't like a New Urbanist project, it must not really be New Urbanist." but there's a fuller answer, which is more honest, which is to say that every single project every single new urbanist project is a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every project I've ever worked on is a compromise. And it's a compromise between the ideals that you're trying to serve and the existing regime of rules and standards and ordinances that are in place in the place that you're working. And perhaps not only that, but a compromise that accepts the existing regional organization of a place that makes a truly integrated transit-oriented development impossible. And so, you know, while the new urbanists, and myself as well, work as hard as we can at the policy level and at the largest, you know, governmental level to encourage regional planning and the sort of regional decision-making, for example, eliminating school size minimums that create sprawl. While we do all that on the one hand, we also feel it's worthy and important to design communities within those existing regimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Kentlands doesn't really function. There's a bus straight to the metro, but Kentlands really doesn't function effectively as a transit community. You know, Kentlands was not subject to as stringent an affordable housing provision ordinance as it could have been. You know, for example, all the things that need to happen at the regional scale for the right things to happen at the local scale weren't there. But that so when you go to Kentlands, and if you get in a car and you're in Georgetown, you get in a car and you close your eyes and then you open them again and you get to Kentlands, it could be said to be a disappointment. But as we like to say, you know, if you get in a car in Tyson's Corner, or frankly any of the surrounding subdivisions, and then arrive in Kentlands, it's a revelation. And in fact, when I lived in Kentlands, people would drive there to walk their dogs in Kentlands because of the different environment that it provided. But, you know, for a lot of people, it's just bare-looking sprawl, and that's because they have an absolutist view that either you get it all right or almost all of it right, or you shouldn't be playing into the existing system. And many of us will agree that the existing system is broken, but new urbanists are pragmatists and believe there's more to be gained by reforming the existing system than there is to simply withdrawing from that system. The most pronounced critique that I've ever heard about this, and I won't tell you who said it or who he was speaking about, but I think it's a legitimate critique, is there's not a site in existence that certain new urbanists build on. And obviously, nobody's going to build on the buttes of Arizona or or other, you know, ecologically sensitive sites. But when it comes to a site, there are many new urbanists who, if a site is in an existing area that's planned for development, or that's adjacent to development, or that is even just someday slated for development, they will accept that job. And even though it's contributing ultimately, the location of these new people in this place will add congestion to overtaxed roadways, will make the regional sprawl picture worse, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason is that these new urbanists feel, and I haven't answered the question myself of how I feel. It's the toughest question in the business. These new urbanists feel that it's so important to create a positive example for what greenfield development can be that doing it on any site is better than not doing it. A secondary argument, which is the most rationalized argument of all, but still I think a legitimate argument, is that this site will be developed either as a single-use enclave that contributes a tremendous amount of trips to the surrounding roads if it's single-use, or it will be developed as a mixed-use new urbanist community that satisfies many of its trips internally and that provides a much better quality of life for the people who are going to live in it. And if, indeed, the site is going to be developed, then there's a very strong argument to be made that, yes, it's worth developing it as a new urbanist site rather than not developing it at all. So this is where you get into the most kind of difficult moral questions surrounding the work, and they're questions that many of us don't have to answer right now because that kind of work isn't really being done right now. And some of us are kind of relieved that we don't have to make that moral judgment because I wouldn't say it's not as simple as there's merit to both arguments. It's not that simple. There are benefits to both solutions. There's benefits to not building on a peripheral site, obviously, if that can be controlled, if that can be made to happen, then obviously don't build on it. But then if the site is going to be built on, it's clearly superior outcome if the development is new urbanist. So I think that the mandate that many of us face and many of us work towards every day is to try to influence policy, again, at the national, the state, and the regional scale to make that sort of greenfield sprawl less likely to happen. But also, as it's happening, many of us feel an obligation. Mine is wavering, but many of us feel an obligation to present the best possible models on that site so that the worst possible model doesn't land on that site.
So if you look at these three objectors, the saints, as you've just discussed, the mods and the libs, say that everything that they said was right and you were to be designing a holistic community. Is there even a viable alternative?
Well, first of all, those three groups could never be expected to agree on anything. So there's no way, there's no viable solution to that would satisfy all of their goals. But the answer to your question is, and we say this in our introduction to the Smart Growth Manual, there may be other solutions than the traditional neighborhood, the traditional mixed-use, compact, walkable, diverse, you know, neighborhood, that are more sustainable. Absolutely, that result in lower carbon, that provide superior qualities of life, in which all the children are above average. those solutions may exist, but none of them have been tested and demonstrated to succeed by the thousands in the same way the traditional neighborhood has. And the reason the Smart Growth Manual is necessary and the reason the new urbanists are necessary is because the discussion of the neighborhood and what constitutes an effective neighborhood model is what's been missing from the discussion for so long. And that without the neighborhood model, everything you do to increase density, everything you do to provide transit, everything you do to mix incomes will not have the desired outcomes. Planning is a profession. I always like to say this, planning is not an art. There's an art to planning, but planning is a profession. And as a profession, we practitioners have a obligation to study past successes and failures. And we have an obligation, many of us would argue, to base new designs on past successes. And if you take that obligation seriously, the only model which has demonstrated its efficacy thousands of times over is the traditional neighborhood. And furthermore, it was the undermining and the loss of that model that's caused development in America to become unsustainable and in the world. So it may not be, in a perfect world, the neighborhood may not be the best solution, but it's the only solution that we know that works, and that's why we feel an obligation as professionals to try to promulgate that model.
When you're actually practicing and designing, any projects that come to mind in particular where you've had to go through this process and apply the theory to the practice?
One of the responses to the article, one of the most thoughtful, although I disagreed with it the most, but one of the most thoughtful responses and the longest response was someone on their blog saying how, what's Speck talking about? The new urbanists have already won. Here he is pretending that everyone hates him and that he's the underdog, and actually he's become, he and his folks are now the man. and they're calling the shots and they're telling HUD what to do, and let's cut with the bull. To which my response was, and it was one of the few responses I took the time to respond to just privately with the blogger, which is, it may seem that way. And certainly the leadership of the development industry and the leadership of the planning industry and the leadership of, government in many places, certainly at the federal level, if you ignore Congress and the highways, and even Obama in the highways.
Those little guys.
Yeah, those little guys. But for to a large extent, the brain has embraced new urbanism. So the ULI is supporting it, and the APA is supporting it. So you know, if development is an animal, the brain has embraced new urbanism and made the decision that new urbanism is the right thing. But the body doesn't. It hasn't connected. The brain has yet to send the right nerve signals down to the body, and the body is not making the right decisions. So still, as you see development resuming, for example, in Las Vegas, where thousands of houses sit empty, they're building thousands of more houses because people don't want a house that's been sitting empty now for 3 years. They're afraid of mold and other things. So developers are building more of the exact same stuff. And so the body doesn't know what the brain is thinking, and we may have won the intellectual argument, but on the ground we're still far from having won. The other analogy I like to use is the ocean liner, where the captain's given the command to turn the boat around, but you know, the iceberg is straight ahead, and the Titanic, it takes a long time to turn that boat around. I think that's where we are. But in response to your question, the point I wanted to make is that every project I've ever worked on has been a huge fight. So when they tell me you've won and that, you know, everyone's accepting what you're saying, I just want to put them next to me in the chair with the, you know, Dane County Public Works Director, where we're trying to get reasonably narrow streets in a principally residential mixed-use community that actually all the CNUers can visit next year, Middleton Hills in Wisconsin. Okay, granted, that was in 93, if you can believe that. That was, oh my God, 17 years ago. But these battles continue to this day, where every project that we work on, we absolutely have to fight to get the right width streets. We absolutely have to fight to get the irregular intersections that make driving and walking safer. We absolutely have to fight to get the buildings as close to the street as they should be. We have to fight to get the most communities don't want schools. Most communities do not want you to have a school in a project that kids can walk to because they don't want to have to pay for them. And there's good reason for them to feel that way given the way the current things currently work in America. Most communities don't want affordable housing. They want the next community to handle it. So every single one of these things that makes, let's just say, of the 300 things that make a community new urbanist, probably 150 of them you have to fight for. And so turning theory into reality is what we do, and it's an absolute battle. And it's a battle that we relish, which is why we're in this business. The other point I want to make is that for some of us, it's a virtue of the economy. For others of us like me, who I have a practice that's so small that I'm able to pick and choose the jobs that I do completely, I've limited myself to working in inner cities in existing places because that for me is the absolute most fun. And it's what new urbanists do and have done for years, but don't get credit for as much as they should because the changes are subtle and take time. It's not like a greenfield project where you start with nothing and you end up with something and you can put it on the cover of a book. This work is much more, it's hard to tell what's new and what's old, what did the planner accomplish, what was already there, but so much of what we're doing now, many new urbanists, and myself pretty much exclusively, is plans to make existing cities and older cities more successful, more walkable, more livable, and their turning theory into practice is a very simple matter, principally of changing the current status of the movement of vehicles as being the principal design driver in the community.
It's my understanding that one of your more interesting smaller projects was actually the design of the renovation of your personal residence in a very walkable neighborhood, Washington, D.C. Is that right?
Almost. It wasn't a renovation. It was a greenfield.
In D.C.
if you can call a brownfield. If you can call a 500-square-foot lot that was empty but littered with trash and drug paraphernalia a greenfield, it was a very sharp corner at the intersection of a street and an avenue in D.C., which had been had once had a row house on it that was torn down years and years ago, and because of the existing zoning codes in D.C., was not a buildable lot, even though it was a horrendous missing tooth and piece of blight in an otherwise revitalizing neighborhood. So there's an example of how codes get in the way. You know, an essentially suburban, I have to give him a little more credit than that, a suburban-influenced land use code in the city of D.C. Placed upon this lot certain requirements that caused it to remain unbuilt year after year after year, even though it was a prominent corner in the city. And in D.C. we have many such lots because, you know, in L'Enfant's plan, the diagonals are slicing up the grid, and you end up with these pie-shaped lots where the zoning code does not in any way address the fact that they're pie-shaped. So the floor area ratio, the lot coverage, et cetera, that I was allowed, the number of square footage that I was, square feet that I was allowed to have, would not allow me to build the proper building for the site, which is a flat iron building. So, and in addition, in a neighborhood in which nobody has a garage, nobody has a curb cut, and nobody parks their car on site, because it's an historic neighborhood of old row houses, I was required to park a car on site. So it was a nine-month process to change the floor area ratio, change the lot coverage, change the parking requirement, and actually get some overhang permissions to build a house, which if people want to see it online, they can just go to my website, jeffspeck.com, and there's links to images of the house. And I guess I should direct people generally to my website because it has a whole bunch of different stuff on it. But a perfect example of going from the largest scale to the smallest of how often existing rules make doing the right thing, what everyone agrees is the right thing, make it impossible, and how if you fight for 9 months, or sometimes less or sometimes longer, you can do the right thing, but you have to be motivated by a larger goal because a typical developer wouldn't bother.
So 50 years from now, what's the one accomplishment you would like to most look back on?
I always say I had one, I won't take credit for a lot, but I had one moment of genius in my career, which was to identify the genius of Andres and Liz. And I certainly wasn't the first person, by far the first person, to do that. But, you know, I owe my career to the fact that I got in with them fairly early and not only recognized the brilliance of their work, but then helped to popularize it through Suburban Nation, which was a delight to write with them. And I'm a wonderful quote at the company 25th reunion that happened a number of years ago. I'm one of many people who's in their shadow, but there's enough room in Andres and Liz's shadow for a million trees to bloom. they're not the only ones, of course, but they are so important to the history of planning. I think posterity will show that Andres and Liz were the most. I think probably people already agree they were the most influential planners of their generation. But that if indeed we are able to turn this ship around before it crashes, much of the credit should go to Andres and Liz. The other moment of genius in my career is realizing that I could be a practicing planner on my own. In my own firm, which is almost a one-man firm, and have the pleasure of working on all these projects at my own pace in my own house with my two tiny children and my wife, and be able to both enjoy the pleasures of a meaningful career, but also I hope balance it with a family life that's a truly urban and that benefits from all of the advantages that we've been discussing, truly urban family life in the heart of Washington.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Wow, we talked about three times as long as we thought we would. But, you know, this is something I care deeply about, and I hope it's come through, and I hope no one I've insulted hears this discussion.
Thanks for listening to the New Urban Architect Podcast, produced by W. Brant Hay Architect. Check us out on the web at newurbanarchitect.com.